And I'm not calling all white people racist because y'all not. But for the ones who want to get on my page talking about all lives matter, show me in American history where all lives have mattered.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, another suspicious death in police custody, another trending hashtag, Sandy Speaks. Sandra Bland often posted videos on Facebook about racial justice and police brutality under the rubric Sandy Speaks. Driving to a new job at her alma mater, Prairie View A&M, she reportedly failed to signal a lane change. A state trooper in Waller County, Texas, pulled her over and then arrested her for allegedly assaulting him. 3 days later, she was found hanging in her cell. Suicide, said the officials. Inconceivable, said her family and friends. This is from one of her videos.
Show me in American history where all lives have mattered. Show me where there has been liberty and justice for all. White people, if all lives mattered, would there need to be a hashtag for Black Lives Mattering? Think about that. Just truly think about that. Yes, black-on-black crime numbers are extremely high. Yes, they are, but that is because there are uneducated people who are hell-bent on self-extermination. I am not one of them. I am into building up my kings and queens. So for me, Black Lives Matter. And then subset, All Lives Matter. Take it or leave it. Sandy Speaks.
This is a summer of grim anniversaries. It's a year since Eric Garner died from a police chokehold in Staten Island, a year since Michael Brown was shot by an officer in Ferguson, Missouri. Black Lives Matter, the movement and the hashtag, is 2 years old this week. Born after George Zimmerman was acquitted in the death of Trayvon Martin in Florida, it's become a slogan used around the world, although not always as its creators intended. Patrice Cullors is one of the three co-founders of Black Lives Matter, along with Alicia Garza and Opal Tometi. When the not guilty verdict was announced in the Zimmerman case late on Saturday, July 13th, 2013, Patrice Cullors learned about it on social media.
I paused in shock and probably 30 seconds later just started crying. If this person, who was just a regular person, could kill a young Black boy and get away with it, who else could do this? And what did this actually mean? It was this moment where I understood that this was an urgent matter. And if we didn't deal with it, if we didn't respond, it would be a missed opportunity.
And how did Black Lives Matter emerge from that?
A lot of Black folks went to social media just trying to vent and make sense of what we just witnessed. Alicia Garza wrote a love note to Black people that affirmed our lives and our value. She closed off with, "Our lives matter, we matter, Black lives matter." I write underneath it, hashtagged Black Lives Matter. The words Black Lives Matter just continued to reverberate within me. And I sent her a Facebook status, and I said, "Twin," because that's what we call each other, "I think we're onto something. We should create a Black Lives Matter platform, both online and offline."
But as it's grown, it's also morphed, and it's spawned other hashtags. Migrant Lives Matter, Women's Lives Matter, Brown Lives Matter. You see this as a problem, right?
Yes. We have 26 chapters across the country and one chapter inside of Toronto, Canada. It isn't just a hashtag. The hashtag has a set of guiding principles that we've created for our network. It was birthed from three Black women in particular who had a very specific politic around Black Lives Matter. And we think when you alter the hashtag, it actually dilutes the messaging. And it's just not creative. And we think that taking, you know, the Black Lives Matter hashtag and adding your own isn't original. We think there can be much more creativity to how we build solidarity.
Hey, you sound like that old guy who says, "Get off my lawn."
No, not at all. I think in front of the hashtag, I say all Black Lives Matter. And we started saying all Black Lives Matter when we noticed that people were only talking about Black Lives Matter as Black men who are being killed by law enforcement. Black people are trans. Black people are queer. Black people are prisoners. Black people exist in every sector of society, and we can't just narrow our understanding of who is actually Black. We've called on non-Black communities to utilize Black Lives Matter to interrogate how you've been impacted by anti-Black racism. So you'll see hashtags like Asians for Black Lives.
So the playing on it like that is good.
Yes, because it's an act of solidarity versus trying to imitate, or at worst, like All Lives Matter, an act of trying to erase.
Right. These willful appropriations of the phrase that question its premise, the all
exactly.
lives matter, white lives
exactly.
matter.
Yep. Police lives matter.
Did that response surprise you?
I'm not surprised by people's need to hold on to the past, but I'm disturbed by it. Why would one want to hold on to a narrative that is about the violation and destruction of a particular group of people? Right now, the focus is law enforcement violence, but let's not hold it there. Across the country, different people have taken up Black Lives Matter to discuss issues of labor in the Black community, utilizing Black Work Matters. You've seen people talk about the killings of Black trans women. Black trans lives matter. It isn't in the mainstream as of yet, but it's in people's consciousness that this is about a larger conversation.
But it's harder to organize around an issue like homelessness or lower graduation rates. It's a lot easier to organize around a police shooting or a trial or a lack of a trial.
But I'll say 10 or 15 years ago, it was very difficult to get media to discuss law enforcement violence in the way that it is. So mostly it takes time. And I think we can't allow ourselves to become narrow in how we discuss and how we practice Black Lives Matter.
You've also observed that this issue itself has centered around male victims at the expense of attention to women. There was Renisha McBride, killed in November 2013 when she sought help after a car crash in a Detroit suburb. Tanisha Anderson of Cleveland, who died in police custody last year after being restrained. Rakia Boyd in Chicago was killed in 2012 by an off-duty cop who thought he saw a gun that wasn't there. Those names are rarely mentioned. Why do you think that is?
We know that Black men are the lead victims. And so I think what happens is people run with that narrative. They run with a narrative of saving young Black men. Earlier this year, we put on actions with Black Youth Project 100, hashtag say her name, really calling on the country to stage protests just like you would for Black men, also for Black women.
What change, if any, have you seen in the past 2 years since you first put that hashtag in front of Black Lives Matter?
I've seen so many changes. I've seen people reorient and reorganize their lives to fight for Black lives. I've seen elected officials say Black Lives Matter. I've seen the entire country try to deal with issues of state violence in ways that I've never witnessed in my lifetime.
Patrice, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Patrice Cullors is one of three co-founders of Black Lives Matter. She's also founder of Dignity and Power Now, an organization for incarcerated people and their families. The events of recent years have underscored how poorly Americans divided by race or income or neighborhood understand each other. It's a disconnect the mainstream media can no longer afford to ignore.
The LA Times has added a new reporter to its staff. That's not usually news, but what he is covering, Morgan, is causing a bit of a sensation. He's covering Black Twitter.
Dexter Thomas, who has written on the internet, youth culture, and social justice, who's also a scholar of Japanese hip-hop, joined the LA Times to report on, among other things, this nebulous space in the Twitterverse. Media outlets often portray Black Twitter with a kind of distant curiosity. But Black Twitter paints a skewed picture, says Thomas. What's more, it gives journalists an easy way out of talking to actual Black people.
The thing is, and we have to face this, Black people are scary. I'm speaking from a mainstream American experience. They're very interested in observing them. and they're very interested in, you know, things like hip hop and things like jazz and whatnot. But when it actually comes to speaking to somebody, it's a little bit scary. So where this leaves reporters is finding a safe black person to talk to. And sort of every network's got one or two of those. But now we don't need that anymore, because actually what we can do is we can just glance at Twitter and say, oh, well, this is what black people think. We see a lot of roundups and listicles saying, here's what black Twitter said last night. That fulfills the diversity requirement of any media outlet. Oh, look, at least we're talking about black people here. But you're not. You're talking about a very fractured subset of black internet users.
Well, in that column you wrote last year called Black People, Please Stop Using Twitter. If we do, maybe the researchers will go away. It was prompted by a study of black Twitter that was undertaken by researchers at the University of Southern California's Annenberg Lab. I'm going to quote you. You said, the researcher can observe black people from the comfort of a computer screen. Information about blackness will then be evaluated, filtered, and selectively curated by a small group of white researchers and presented for the perusal and entertainment of a largely white audience. Will you be now doing that curation and translation for a largely white audience?
No, I'm not interested in doing that. What I'm not interested in is these sort of old, tired ideas that we have about certain ethnicities. People out there who say, well, black people online, they speak in code that's unintelligible to white people. And that's not true. Basically, there's two websites that you need, Urban Dictionary and Rap Genius, or now it's genius.com. A perfect example of this, actually, is the Ask Rachel meme. So if everybody remembers Rachel Dolezal,
the white person who was passing herself off as black.
Right. But the thing was, she was being extremely convincing. Not only did she have braids, but she was able to talk about black hair in this very, very specific way. I think it sort of freaked a lot of black people out, because it said, okay, well, hold on a second. I thought this was this arcane black knowledge. And no, it's not. And so the Ask Rachel hashtag, the idea is that only black people would be able to answer these questions. So, for example, fill in the blank, rolling down the street, smoking Indo, sipping on gin, and juice would be the correct answer here. Now, if you're not a black person, you don't know this. But it's silly to say that, because lots of white people listen to Snoop Dogg. There's some white kid in North Dakota right now who could ace that Ask Rachel test. Now, I could go give that to Louis Farrakhan. He would fail it. That doesn't mean he's not black.
So your larger point here is that this notion that there's this impenetrable world out there that has to be translated is ridiculous. These cultural memes translate across the races. And you don't love the word community because it suggests a monolith. You like communities. So give me an example of some of the divisions that show that there's no monolith here.
One thing would be misogyny. Another would be homophobia. Another would be transphobia. There's a rapper named Tyga. There was a rumor that he was dating a woman for 3 years, cheating on his girlfriend. The complication here is that the woman he's dating is transgender. Tyga was trending last week, and if you looked at the tweets, most of them were homophobic and transphobic words that people know are offensive. But on the flip side, as far as we know in the media, black Twitter is two things. It's people getting mad about police brutality and Beyonce jokes. So how do we reconcile that? We can't. There are people in black Twitter who identify themselves as being part of black Twitter. And when bad things happen to black men, they're the first ones to talk about it, and they're very angry. But when bad things happen to black women, they're nowhere to be found. But then on the other hand, you do have people who are part of black Twitter who say, hey, that's not okay. All black lives matter. It's really fragmented, is what I'm saying. Black Twitter is just like white Twitter.
So how do you plan to use this space as a reporter? What specific stories live online among those black communities that don't yet have a home in the mainstream media?
For example, the response on Twitter and different social media to the shooting of Akai Gurley in New York. The person who shot this young man was Asian American. And so from what I've seen, the Asian American community was a little bit split. On one hand, there were people who were saying, we need to support the police officer, Peter Lang. We need to support him because, well, he's Asian American like us, and we can't allow people to sort of bully this guy. But then on the other hand, Asian American activists saw this and said, no, this is contributing to anti-Black violence. Now, there are Black people who are seeing this, and sometimes they're seeing only the people who are trying to support the police officer, and they say, oh, well, see, look, all Asians are just as racist and as bad as white people. They're trying to hold us down. But then you've got other people who see both sides of it. There's all sorts of alliances and conflicts. In general, in the media, the way that we talk about minorities, we talk about Black people and white people. We talk about Asian people and white people. We talk about Latinos and white people. We forget that sometimes minorities talk to each other. White people don't always have to be at the center of these conversations. So I'm interested in those.
Is there any concern that Black Twitter itself could change, become less open, as the mainstream media become more and more interested in it?
That's already happened.
Yeah?
That ship sailed a long time ago. Whenever the first article came out in 2009 about late-night Black people Twitter, people have been observing it. I mean, this is what we have to understand, is that there is no such thing as a safe space in 2015. The Black conversation is part of the national conversation, and there is no hiding. But what we can do is speak louder. And we have been doing that with Twitter. I'd just like to help people talk a little louder, really, at the end of the day.
Dexter, thank you very much.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dexter Thomas is a reporter for the LA Times. In the wake of tragic encounters, we always call for a national conversation. Coming up, you'll hear one. You can assess its value. This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. In the lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer, we've opted for stupid political polls and loopy robot humor. But this week, there's no getting past the mayhem. Just days before the anniversary of Eric Garner's death by police chokehold, his family received a settlement from New York City for $5.9 million.
People were walking up and down the street, they're saying congratulations.
Garner's mother, Gwen Carr.
Don't congratulate us. This is not a victory. The victory will come when we get justice.
In the last 12 months, Garner's name and his final words, "I can't breathe," have come to signify a cultural malaise as well as a call to action. And as we've observed, coverage of such deaths tends to follow a pattern. Local reports, then protests, then mainstream news catching on, then hashtags, attempts to blame the victim, remarks from elected officials, and then inevitably...
We have to have a national conversation about how police forces should interact with the African-American community.
We have to have a candid national conversation about race and about discrimination.
And my hope is that finally we have a national conversation about race.
But what's that really sound like? And does it really matter? Last week, our colleague Brian Lehrer at WNYC in New York City hosted one such conversation in the form of a live radio program in collaboration with media outlets in St. Louis and Baltimore. Listeners called in from all three cities and beyond, joining guests that were journalists, activists, and law enforcement. We've pulled out some moments to see if anything can be achieved, has been achieved, by 2 years of talk.
I feel the real problem here is that white people tend to only view black people as thugs and drug dealers. They don't look at us as professional doctors, lawyers, teachers. So it's like, yeah, I can deal with you at work, but I'm not going to invite you over for dinner. I'm not going to have you at my barbecue. I really don't want to get to know you.
Do you need to get that invitation to the barbecue in order to have justice?
No, to start a dialogue. Say, I'm just like you. I have the same struggles.
You're not convinced by the African-American woman caller from St. Louis that we're having a more productive set of racial interactions in the last year.
To a certain degree, but it's not enough, because you can say one thing in the office or out in public, and then when you go home, you're going to say something else. You're going to do something else. It's not a real conversation unless you kind of invite people to the party, so to speak.
We presented Patricia from New Jersey as an opening salvo. This next part includes a conversation among activists, a former Baltimore police officer turned professor, WNYC anchor and legal analyst Jamie Floyd, and more callers. You'll hear the disconnect here, disputes over facts and words and basic premises. It starts with a clip of Darren Wilson on ABC, the Ferguson police officer who was not indicted for the fatal shooting of Michael Brown last August.
I guess it's hard to have a normal life after someone is lying dead.
Mm-hmm.
Something you think that will always haunt you?
I don't think it's a haunting. It's always going to be something that happened.
You have a very clean conscience.
The reason I have a clean conscience is because I know I did my job right.
Listeners keep calling us from all three cities. What's changed in the year since Michael Brown and Eric Garner died, and what needs to change next? With us now, DeRay McKesson, well-known activist, organizer, and member of the group We the Protesters, and St. Louis community leader Brittany Packnett, executive director for Teach for America in St. Louis, and the youngest member of President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. Ms. Packnett, how much do you accept the grand juries and the U.S. Justice Department's non-indictments of Officer Wilson, whose voice we heard a moment ago? The conclusions based on the credible witnesses seem to be, according to them, that Michael Brown had tried to get the officer's gun, was moving toward him, not away from him at the time of the shooting, did not have his hands up. Could it be that protesters were right on the big picture about Ferguson, as the Justice Department then reported on, but wrong on Darren Wilson?
Respectfully, I would dismiss the premise of the question, because ultimately we are talking about a situation on August 9th, not the last incident in which a young person of color, a young African-American man in particular, has lost their life. Regardless of the details, I think that we can all agree that a life lost for whatever Michael Brown did or didn't do was incredibly unnecessary. I want to make sure that we don't get focused on trying to find the perfect victim or the perfect situation and ignore the systemic issues that continue to leave people dead in the streets.
So systemically, DeRay McKesson, how much do you think we're at a moment of historic national change?
What is important about the space that's been created is that people now understand that the police are not infallible. The video with Walter Scott, like everything that the police said never happened, happened in that video.
That was the South Carolina case where a police officer shot a man in the back as he was running away, unarmed.
Yep, and they lied about it. It was a cover-up. So people are starting to see the structure and the system needs to change. I think that there'll be a focus on police contracts soon. I think that there'll be a focus on laws. I think there'll be a focus on, like, the culture of policing changing, too, with things like training.
And with our protest leader guests, Brittany Packnett and DeRay McKesson, we bring back in former Baltimore police officer Peter Moskos, now a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York and author of the book Cop in the Hood. Can we find common ground here?
There might be some common ground. I think, look, America's got issues, historical and current, systemic issues with racism and poverty and also crime. We need to address those issues, mental health issues in particular, that police officers have to deal with. We shouldn't, however, use police officers as somehow representative of all this historical and evil in America. At some point, we need to stop telling police what not to do and tell them what to do. That's why cops right now feel they're in such an awkward position, because they simply don't know what is acceptable anymore. Of course cops shouldn't shoot innocent people. Police will tell you that too. But the question is, what do we do with the crime that's out there?
Who wants to jump in?
I think the response is really easy.
Everyone wants to jump in.
Go ahead, Ms. Packnett.
One of the first things that we need to do is stop denying reality, right? The Equal Justice Initiative actually just put out a really great video under the hashtag Slavery Evolved that very clearly connects the dots between this transatlantic slave trade and American slavery to mass incarceration and the systems of criminal justice today. And so if we continue to allow people to operate as proprietors of that system without ensuring that they face the reality that, yes, they are working in a system that many people for many centuries have very good and justifiable reason not to trust, then we are allowing people to get off the hook. When we think about the fact that public servants derive their authority from the people, continuing to be accountable to those people is absolutely and fundamentally necessary at all times.
That's all true, but what should a police officer do when the resident calls and says, I want drug dealers off my stoop? So the cop pulls up, now what? We should end the drug war. That's one possible solution.
Mm-hmm. If I could finish, one of the things that we need to begin with, again, is that education piece, such that police officers are operating with respect in the communities that they serve, creating the kind of trust and legitimacy that allows them to do their jobs. The kind of policing that happens in schools, another thing that we can do is actually create really positive interactions for young people and police officers instead of highly punitive ones. If you look at some of the work that the Ferguson Commission is doing right now, if you look at nonprofits and organizations and grassroots activists from around the country, we've presented lots and lots of solutions. And so I'm not going to agree with the premise that the solutions aren't out there. It's a matter of whether or not we're going to take them seriously.
The societal solutions, I think you're absolutely right on, but it still doesn't help the line officer on the street who gets a call and has to deal with the criminal. I'm not disagreeing with your other points, but there's a real issue of cops having to interact with people. I don't see solutions for that.
That's like so easy. This idea that like, they are interacting with people, and in that interaction, that this might just be an outcome. And, like, that just isn't okay, right? That, like, they didn't need training not to beat that girl in McKinney, Texas. They should have actually just made a different choice. And they made a choice that they should be held accountable for. And it shouldn't have taken 15 more hours or any new course in training not to manhandle a girl in a bathing suit.
Absolutely. The young woman at the swimming pool in McKinney, Texas, you're referring to, this is Jamie Floyd. I think we have to acknowledge that being a police officer is a tough job, that they face a real danger. At the same time, officers are required to maintain their professionalism and composure. And we have to acknowledge that we're locked in a tragic feedback loop and that we're repeating a past that is mired in racism and that our country is refusing to this very day to address. And we need to, I think, start taking advantage of the decline in crime to make a distinction between criminals and people who are not engaged in crime, so that when these encounters occur, we don't encounter each individual citizen, especially when they have brown or black skin, as a criminal.
Let me bring another caller into the conversation. Tom in Manhattan, you're on the program. Hello.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate it. What I've noticed, I've lived in New York City my entire life. I'm in my 50s. I'm a doctor at a local hospital here. I've taken care of many cops. And with due respect to your experts, I mean, what kind of society do these people think they'd be living in if there was no police force?
DeRay McKesson, do you want to engage the caller?
Yeah, I take offense to this idea of these people, right? That is, again, language that, like, hints to a mindset that's really unproductive. But I will say that, like, we've been seduced to believe that more police are, like, essential to a crime prevention strategy, and they are not. Crime prevention is based on, like, healthy neighborhoods, strong schools, grocery stores in places. You know, more police don't actually stop crime. They move crime. So, like, we have to, like, be more creative when we think about crime prevention strategies. And, again, police officers do have hard jobs. Like you said, black people have hard realities living in America, too, right? That it is not simply about, like, how hard something is. We are making excuses for people who are choosing to kill people and excuses for the system that are not holding them accountable. And that's just not okay.
Peter Moskos?
It baffles me to still hear today that police are irrelevant to crime reduction. Of course police matter. After the riots in Baltimore, because of changes in policing, the murder rate literally doubled overnight.
There were no riots in Baltimore.
Well.
What do you call them?
The uprising, maybe? Oh,
that's so sweet, but it's really patronizing to those that actually with agency cut fire hoses and loot stores. But that's a difference we'll have to accept. But after the riots in Baltimore, the homicide rate doubled.
Can I chime in here, Brian? Because the murder rate in Baltimore was skyrocketing before Freddie Gray died.
That's Roberto Alejandro from WEAA. Go ahead, Roberto.
Yeah, so
it was up about, 30%?
Yeah, but the point is both shootings and homicides were well ahead of last year's pace before Freddie died.
It went up
after the riots, that pace simply continued.
Well, that's not quite right.
And let's not forget that as things get warmer, especially in places like Baltimore City, things get more violent.
Yeah, murders went down last month. Now, see, all those are tried and true cliches, but they don't reflect the reality of what we're seeing in Baltimore or America.
Ms. Packett, we'll give you the last word before our break. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I do not believe that I heard DeRay say that police don't play a role in society. What I heard him say is that the root of issues of crime and oppression and poverty are not solved by police. They're solved by other systems. And so we have to allow a real look at how we take oppression out of those existing systems.
It's a three-city call-in on race and justice in this summer that's 1 year after the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York. For St. Louis, Baltimore, New York, we continue in a minute.
In this part of the conversation, you'll hear St. Louis reporter Rachel Lipman and Baltimore journalists Roberto Alejandro and Joel McCord and WNYC's Jamie Floyd. And from black and white, impatience with the achingly slow pace of change.
And let's go to our next caller, which is Diana. Did I say your name right?
Yes, Diana.
Hey. Diana, hi.
I'm 17 from Baltimore, and I'm very optimistic for change, and so most of my peers, we've been a part of this awesome organization called the Inner Harbor Project. And in this project, we have a youth-led training for officers to bridge the gap between teens and them in Baltimore. We've developed the training as teens. Like, we did it from research that we had and focus groups, and it was a lot of work. In our training, we have a pre-test and a post-test. And on the post-test, our officers scored like 100 across the board.
What's the most important thing that you think this youth training imparts in the police officers? What do they learn from you guys?
They learn communication and empathy and respect. Basically, they learn how to talk to youth instead of being that authority figure that they come off as.
Good luck with it, and I'm glad you're optimistic. Agnes in the Bronx.
How are you doing? I don't know where to begin. My fire is lit from so many burners here. Nothing has changed here in New York. I don't know what Poppyfield Mullins walked through before he got here to say
the leader of the Sergeants Union in New York City, an earlier guest.
The bottom line here in New York is stop and frisk has wreaked havoc on the black and Latino community. And we're no longer accepting the trust me, I feel you, your pain, new community cop. Let's have a meeting because, no, we've already met. We already have laws on the books forbidding racial profiling. You have the Department of Justice. You have the New York State government. You have the Attorney General. You have the Division of Human Rights. You have all these laws in place, and still you put the architect of broken windows in charge.
Police Commissioner William Bratton. Agnes, thank you very much. Arlene in St. Louis. You're on WNYC. Hello, Arlene.
Hi. I live in St. Louis, Missouri, in a suburb called University City, which is probably about 4 or 5 miles southeast of Ferguson. First point I'd like to make is that I think it's crucial that independent prosecutors must be appointed whenever there's use of force by a police that injures a civilian. There's absolutely no way that a prosecuting attorney, for example, here in St. Louis County, who knows all the police because he has to use them as witnesses in various cases, can be objective in deciding whether or not charges to be brought or how to present the charges to the grand jury. So I think that that's one reform that's desperately needed throughout the country in any states that do not have an independent prosecutor statute.
Great. Arlene, thank you very much. And so let me go to Rachel Lipman, courts and public safety reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Rachel, Arlene from St. Louis brings up the need for an independent prosecutor in these kinds of cases. We heard earlier in the program from New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who took a big step in that direction for New York State today. He said any case involving a police shooting of an unarmed civilian or a civilian who it's disputed whether the person was armed or not, that case is being taken away from the local prosecutors and grand jury and being given to the state attorney general. After Ferguson and after the non-indictment, is there any serious discussion of something similar there, as Arlene is calling for?
You've seen it presented in the legislature in bill form, mostly by Democratic state senators and representatives from the area around Ferguson. But the dynamics of Missouri politics are such that you're unlikely to see a Democratic governor, which we have right now, take the step to do that. And measures calling for outside prosecution or outside evaluation of officer-involved shootings did not go anywhere in the legislature, which is controlled by Republicans.
And Baltimore people, how about that dynamic there? Joel McCord from WIPR.
At least in Baltimore, blue trumps black. It's not so much a question of race in Baltimore. It's a police mentality that needs to change.
Roberto from WEAA.
It's certainly true that the police hold incredible sway, but a lot of the established political class is sort of seen as helping better off African-Americans in the city, but doing less for low-income African-Americans.
What makes Baltimore different from the other two cities on the program today? There was an indictment.
Marilyn Mosby, our new state's attorney, represents a sort of generational shift where you're starting to see a younger class of politicians who are very committed to lower income communities in ways that the city hasn't historically seen.
And let's take another caller. It's Liz in Baltimore. Liz, you're on the program. Hello.
I'm a white person. I live in a white community, but I work with kids who are in the Penn North area in Baltimore. I mean, I think the bottom line is, white people need to start talking about white supremacy and name it for what it is. You know, if I hear another white person in Baltimore say, well, that's not representative of Baltimore, that has nothing to do with me, like, I'm going to scream, you know? And I think white people need to start putting some skin in the game, because we need to say that white supremacy is unacceptable and we need to start working to change it.
And what does it mean to put skin in the game after you say, as a white person, white supremacy is real and unacceptable?
You know, in Baltimore, we have a lot of kids that are protesting and getting arrested and doing things in favor of social justice and racial equality, but white people just aren't doing it. You know, people come and they clean up after the riot and then they leave, and everyone's really concerned for like a week and then it dies down. And I think that the fact that we've had a black commissioner and a black mayor just shows you can put black faces into a white system and you still have white supremacy. Mm-hmm.
Jamie in New York?
The real question in New York and everywhere is whether these ugly encounters that we are seeing represent some sort of tipping point, a transformational moment, or whether, as many of the frustrated callers have been suggesting, this is just more of the same. Are we just seeing the same tradition of Oscar Grant and Sean Bell? And I could go back to Clifford Glover. Anybody know him? 1973, 10 years old, Jamaica, Queens, shot by the NYPD. Emmett Till, we all know that name, or we should. It can't just be a conversation between and amongst black people and communities of color. We have to speak to each other openly and honestly about racism. It's a conversation we have never honestly had in this country. You know, if you look at the numbers from 2003 to 2009, just under 5,000 people died while a member of law enforcement was trying to arrest or restrain them. If we talk about 98 million arrests made nationally, that's not that big a number. But if you look at the number itself, well, we could report a different arrest every single day that ended in death. So the question is there going to be change, or are we going to be having this conversation in another 10 years?
That is our three-city call-in on race and justice to acknowledge the anniversaries this summer of the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York. May they rest in peace.
So, all in all, pretty good conversation, a vector for venting and information. What's it accomplish? Obviously not much, but multiply it 10,000-fold and you begin to feel a rumble beneath your feet. Baltimore's attorney hands out indictments. New York's governor appoints a special prosecutor. The Justice Department excoriates law enforcement in Ferguson. The FBI investigates a death in a Texas jail. Not enough, not nearly enough, but with the steady pressure of a fierce, relentless conversation, a rumble can become a roar.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The web was roiled this week by the resignation of Reddit CEO Ellen Pao, reigniting the hoary argument over whether free speech must come at the cost of harassment and hate. Despite Reddit's significant role in shaping internet discourse, it seems like almost every article you read about it includes the phrase "Reddit for the uninitiated," followed by an explanation of what it is. It's a question that has confounded countless news outlets.
What is Reddit?
What is Reddit?
What is Reddit?
As Slate's Will Oremus explained to PBS in 2013,
Reddit is an online message board. It's a place where anybody can go if they just sign up and post a message about pretty much anything they want. These messages are divided into a bunch of different topic threads called subreddits.
Comedian Chris Hardwick clarified the concept of subreddits on a recent episode of his game show At Midnight.
There's a subreddit for literally anything you could possibly think of. There's also a subreddit for every nightmare you could ever have. For 250 points, I want you to tell me which of these strange subreddits is real. F***able mustard or erotic mayonnaise.
Whether Reddit is driving discussion on the seedier side of condiments or spearheading charitable giving campaigns, its influence is undeniable. With over 160 million unique monthly visitors, Reddit is the first port of call for a massive amount of web traffic. Caitlin Dewey is the Washington Post's digital culture critic. She says Reddit's next steps will be heavily scrutinized given the site's critical role in the web's ecosystem.
Reddit is almost like the plankton at the bottom that the bigger fish continue eating. And, you know, whoever's at the top of the food chain, you know, when you see a big viral post on BuzzFeed, you don't necessarily know that the germ of that story started on Reddit, but frequently that's the case.
So give us a quick sum up of what led the CEO, Ellen Pao, to leave.
Ellen Pao inherited a network that was already in a state of chaos that had a lot of problems with very hateful and harassing communities that was getting a lot of really bad press. So Ellen Pao set out to make some changes to the site. The changes weren't very well communicated to the user base. And over the July 4th weekend, there was what a lot of people are calling a Reddit revolt, when a lot of very popular Redditors stood up and said, you know, we don't like the direction that the site is going. We're going to leave Reddit. And in the sort of continuing upheavals around this issue, Ellen Pao resigned.
What sort of changes did she try to make?
She created and then enforced an anti-harassment policy on the site.
How dare her?
Exactly. So she banned five communities that were essentially dedicated to picking out individuals, relentlessly making fun of them, sometimes even harassing them off-site. Two of them were fat-shaming communities. What they would basically do is go on other social networks, say Instagram or Twitter or Facebook, find pictures of overweight people, and then take them back to Reddit and make fun of them, sometimes post their full names, their personal information, that kind of thing. Other communities were doing the same thing for transgender people. Another one that was harassing members of a progressive gaming site, and one that was very openly racist.
I think it was called the Chimpire, this militant network of racist communities, called the web's worst by the Southern Poverty Law Center.
They actually said that it was worse than the forums on Stormfront, which is, of course, a leading white supremacy website. I mean, if Reddit wants to be an absolute free speech forum, that's well and good, but they're certainly not going to get the user growth that their investors are looking for. If Reddit's going to attract those users, it's going to have to crack down on those things. They're going to have to show that Reddit is a safe community. And so far, all of the messaging that new users are receiving are about things like the Chimpire, about things like the Reddit Revolt, about things like jailbait.
Let's talk about jailbait for just a second. It was a site that posted sexually suggestive pictures of children that wasn't porn but fell just short of it. This used to be hosted by Reddit. Where did those jailbaiters go?
If you look hard enough, you can certainly still find jailbait on Reddit. The other place that they've gone is a new Reddit copycat site called Vote.
Vote, as I understand, is run by a kid who's still in college.
The reason that Vote rose to prominence of any kind was because they made these really grandiose promises that you can post everything here that you couldn't post on Reddit. Within weeks of making those claims, Vote's hosting provider suspended the site for hosting illegal right-wing content. And then shortly after that, PayPal, which is the site Vote was using to handle their site donations, froze their account for hosting child porn. So Vote, right off the bat, had to go through and ban all those communities that it said it would allow.
There was an article on Verge called "Reddit is a Failed State," and I want to get your reaction to a quote. "If Reddit wants to be thought of as a government, we'll call it what it is, a failed state unable to control what happens within its borders. At a minimum, Reddit is a kleptocracy that speaks to lofty virtues while profiting from vice."
During Ellen Pao's tenure, which was actually quite brief, Reddit took $50 million of venture capital funding. So I think increasingly there's going to be a financial motive for the site to clean up in order to grow its user base and meet the demands of its investors. Really, these are very existential struggles.
So if this is going to keep happening, a platform gains popularity, attracts society's most toxic elements, responds by tightening its standards, and then the trolls flee to some other new platform, they're like rats. There's nothing to do.
The important thing that can be done is keep these toxic elements, as you say, on the fringes. The problem with these communities existing on Reddit is that it is a very highly trafficked site. We don't want to give them these platforms where their views can be magnified. If they would like to create their own fringe websites out in the ether somewhere, that is certainly their right to do so.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Caitlin Dewey is the Washington Post's digital culture critic. There was a time most Americans saw identity as fixed. You were black or white, straight or gay, and whether you were a man or a woman or neither or both never even came up. When art conflicts with the mainstream view, it struggles and usually dies. Take Fran Ross's Oreo, a satirical novel about a half-Jewish, half-black girl's search for her father. Published 41 years ago, it pretty much sank on arrival. But this month, New Directions Publishing is issuing a new edition, reckoning Oreo's time has come. WNYC's Mythili Rao explores why it's taken so long.
1974. Benny and the Jets by Elton John is at the top of the charts. Philippe Petit walks between the Twin Towers. President Richard Nixon resigns from office. In Boston, there are protests against plans to bus black students to white schools. Stephen King publishes his first novel, and so does a black Philadelphia-born writer named Fran Ross. But where King's Carrie launches a blockbuster career, that other first-time novelist, Ross, and her book titled Oreo, fade into obscurity.
I remember picking it up for the first time and reading a couple pages, and it's so different from anything that you would expect that it's like it's almost alive on the page. And, you know, it's just dancing.
Novelist Matt Johnson.
The first time you encounter it, that's the feeling. It's this shock that how can a book so original, so good, be one that you've probably never heard of before.
But even for ardent admirers like Johnson, summarizing the plot of Oreo is a challenge. It's just that original.
It's basically a retelling of the Theseus myth, but with a black biracial woman searching for her father in this picaresque tale where she leaves Philadelphia, goes to New York, and goes on this odyssey to discover him.
Oreo is littered with Yiddish and slang. Its chapter titles are in Greek. There are charts and diagrams, a list of secret clues, puns, racial stereotypes, physical humor, and bawdy digressions.
It's a flight of fancy, a tour de force of linguistic pyrotechnics.
Poet Harriet Mullen, who teaches English at UCLA, was Oreo's original champion. Years after Ross's death and long after the book was forgotten, Mullen stumbled on Oreo in a used bookstore in Manhattan.
Really a fire trap of books stacked to the ceiling, lots of dust. I had never heard of this author. I had never heard of this title. No one I spoke to had read this book. It was released in, I think, 5,000 copies in 1974, and it just kind of sank.
Reading the book, Mullen was stunned.
It was a novel that seemed to have projected so far into the future that people were really not ready for it.
Her favorite scene comes when Christine Clark, also known as Oreo, winds up in the radio studio of a New York advertising man.
Oreo could hear the strange permutations of words speeded up and slowed down, rushed backward and whisked forward, the barbaric yawp of words cut off in mid-syllable, the choked consonants, the disavowed vowels. Words were all over the floor. Words and time. What word was that there in the corner, curled up like a fetus? And this umbilicus of sound, what Caesarean intervention had ripped it untimely from its mother root?
Christine, a.k.a. Oreo, is recruited to read ad copy targeting Jewish customers. She nails it. It's just one of the many scenes in which Oreo perfectly dons identities as needed. She's just as comfortable masquerading as a Jewish voiceover artist as she is pretending to be an uneducated black maid. Mullen concedes that she herself wouldn't have been ready for this book when it was first published.
I don't know that I would have appreciated it as much in the 70s because I, too, was being swept along with the whole black arts movement.
An outgrowth of the black power movement, the black arts movement was uncompromising in its vision of racial authenticity. Mark Anthony Neal, professor of African American Studies at Duke University, says Oreo's satirical take on racial hybridity was completely at odds with the era. The predominant take on blackness was Alex Haley's Roots. It spent 22 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list and inspired a groundbreaking ABC miniseries.
Your name is Toby. You're going to learn to say your name. Let me hear you say it. What's your name?
Kunta. Kunta Kinte.
Roots traces Haley's lineage directly back to Africa, offering a clear, coherent picture of racial identity. But the tangled, tainted ancestry Ross described did nothing of the sort. Oreo's protagonist Christine is a black girl with an absent white father who speaks Yiddish thanks to her black grandfather. And her nickname, Oreo, comes out of a mishearing of Oriole, which is what Christine's grandmother Louise intended to call her. But Oreo sticks.
You know, like the cookie, white on the inside, brown on the outside.
Mark Anthony Neal.
You know, I'm born 1965. It was a term that was often applied to me, not because I had biracial parents, but because of the way I might talk, because where my friends might have been listening to Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, I was listening to the Police or Poco or something along those lines.
Audiences in the 70s weren't interested in stories of racial contradiction. But in the 90s, when Danzy Senna was living in Brooklyn's Fort Greene neighborhood, her mother, the writer Fanny Howe, told her about Harriet's find. And Danzy found that it fit right in with the culture she saw reflected around her.
Spike Lee had one of his production offices at the end of my street, and it was a generation of black people and biracial people who were born after the civil rights movement and who had a sort of more ironic stance on issues of race and authenticity, coming from many different cultural backgrounds.
Oreo seemed to be in conversation with the black intellectuals and artists Senna saw around her in Brooklyn.
I was reading about it at a moment in Fort Greene when I was living kind of, I feel like, in the epicenter of all of this really interesting artistic energy. And yet, I still felt reading her book that she had already kind of moved past us. So there was this uncanny experience of reading a book from the past that felt like it was from the future.
But Oreo remained on the margins. There's no redemptive plotline, no wisdom passed down from the ages. As Senna writes in her introduction to the new edition, Ross is a hard sell for February, Black History Month, and a hard sell for March, Women's History Month. In truth, the book is a hard sell for any month. Here's Matt Johnson again.
The commercial realities are that people want books that are similar to books that already exist. There's already an audience for them. But the creative impulse is to create something completely new. And when you're creating something completely new, you're also saying we're putting something into a world that doesn't necessarily have a readership yet.
This, sadly, was the story of Ross's career. 3 years after Oreo's publication, she landed a job writing for the Richard Pryor Show in Los Angeles. Pryor's no-holds-barred, envelope-pushing style seemed like a natural fit.
I don't hate white folks. No sorry, Bob. One of my great-great-grandparents was white. I'm sure of it. Because I know I didn't look like this when I came from Africa.
But after Ross gave up her New York apartment and moved out west, Pryor decided he wasn't prepared to make the compromises needed to make his show viable for mass consumption. Ross wound up back in New York. Less than a decade later, she died at age 50. Reading this book now, after Eric Garner and Michael Brown in Charleston, Oreo's playful language, unconventional feminism, and radical ideas about race feel like a much-needed tonic.
We're being forced to acknowledge that we don't live in a race-blind society.
Matt Johnson.
And if we don't live in a race-blind society, then not only does blackness exist, but whiteness exists. And if that's true, then all of a sudden all of us have to deal with deconstructing race to get to our humanity, right? And I think that's what a book like this offers the opportunity for anyone, black, white, Asian, or however you want to categorize. It offers a roadmap to how to take off your skin and really cut it into pieces and create something that actually fits the person inside.
Growing up mixed race and being born in 1970, I think all the depictions I had seen of biracial characters were tragic.
Danzy Senna.
Gay characters and biracial characters always have to come to a very bad end.
For Professor Neal, Ross's willingness to grant power to a biracial protagonist has political implications, too.
Fran Ross laid down the reality of what it meant to be black and grow up multiracial. She created this character that had not been prevalent in the culture except as a butt of jokes. In some ways, if you had the chance to read Oreo, President Obama's presidency makes much more sense.
And so, more than four decades after Oreo's initial release, as we continue to figure out what it means to be biracial or transgender, a man or a woman, black or white, or a little of both, it's worth looking back at a freshly printed copy of Oreo. It'll make you laugh. For On the Media, I'm Maithili Rao.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Sam Dingman, and Jenna Cagle. We had more help from Maya Brownstein, and our show is edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Joe Plord. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.